watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. A few weeks ago on the show, I played for you UK scholar Nafis Ahmed's tour de force overview of the converging crises now coming to a head in the globalized system of industrial capitalism. Climate catastrophe, peak oil, food scarcity, and economic dysfunction. In a recent entry on his blog, he summarized the situation, quote, "This global system is hugely destructive of human life. Devoid of the capability to recognize and enact ethical values, it is driven purely by the imperatives of profit, efficiency, growth, and monopoly. Consequently, it is not only destructive of human life, it is destructive of all life, nature, and even itself. It is now generating multiple crises across the world that over the next 10 to 15 years threaten to converge in an unprecedented and unimaginable way unless we take drastic action now." Close quote. The question is, how do we take action? What action should be taken? What vision guides our action? As a variety of speakers presented on this program have made clear, preserving the status quo is not a workable goal because it is the status quo that is the source of the problem. Dealing with the problem effectively requires nothing less than dismantling this system based on perpetual growth. Economic activity and human population must both shrink to a sustainable level. The question is whether this will come about through chaos and disaster as a result of the failure to confront and deal, or whether these things can be done under the guidance of a different vision, a paradigm shift, where material excess is replaced by prudence, where competition is replaced by cooperation, where greed is no longer good and creativity is no longer enslaved to profit. One could envision a variety of different paths, some very different from the status quo and some not so different. And in fact, the one-size-fits-all approach is not only unnecessary, but probably an impediment. The one thing which there seems to be consensus about is that corporate power is both the cause and the obstacle. Ways forward through this will be the focus of the program this week. I'd like to start by reading you an article titled, "Who Will Rule?" from the fall 2007 issue of Yes Magazine, written by Michael Marks and Marjorie Kelly. In it, they say that citizen movements are proving that we can take on corporate power and together build a future that works for all life. They write, "Corporate power lies behind nearly every major problem we face, from stagnant wages and unaffordable health care to overconsumption and global warming. In some cases, it is the cause of the problem. In other cases, corporate power is a barrier to system-wide solutions. The dominance of corporate power is so pervasive, it has come to seem inevitable. We take it so much for granted we fail to see it. Yet it is preventing solutions to some of the most pressing problems of our time. With global warming a massive threat to our planet, and a majority of U.S. citizens wanting action, Why is the U.S. government so slow to address it? In large part because corporations use lobbying and campaign finance to constrain meaningful headway. Why are jobs moving overseas, depressing wages at home, and leaving growing numbers of under- or unemployed? In large part because trade treaties drafted in corporate-dominated back rooms have changed the rules of the global economy, allowing globalization to massively accelerate on corporation-friendly terms at the expense of workers, communities, and the environment. Why are unions declining and benefits disappearing? In large part because corporate power vastly overshadows the power of labor and governments, and corporations play one region off against another, busting unions to hold down labor costs while boosting profits, fueling a massive run-up in the stock market. Why were electricity, the savings and loan industry, and other critical industries deregulated, contributing to major debacles whose costs are borne by the public? In large part because free market theory, enabled by campaign contributions and lobbying, seduced elected officials into trusting the marketplace to regulate itself. With all this happening, why do we not read more about the pervasiveness of corporate power? In large part because even the Fourth Estate, our media establishment, is majority owned by a handful of mega corporations. Big corporations have become de facto governments, and the ethic that dominates corporations has come to dominate society. Maximizing profits, holding down wages, and externalizing costs onto the environment become the central dynamics for the entire economy and virtually the entire society. What gets lost is the public good, the sense that life is about more than consumption, and the understanding that markets cannot manage all aspects of the social order. What gets lost as well is the original purpose of corporations, which was to serve the public good. The solution is to bring corporations back under citizen control and in service to the public good. The main components of such a movement already exist, including organized labor, environmentalists, religious activists, shareholder activists, students, farmers, consumer advocates, health activists, and community-based organizations. We've seen the power of ordinary people working together on the streets of Seattle in 1999, challenging the World Trade Organization. We've seen them achieve impressive results curbing sweatshop abuses, limiting tobacco advertising, challenging predatory lending practices at home and abroad, and protecting millions of acres of forest, to name just a few successes. We've also seen the growth of community-friendly economic designs like worker-owned enterprises, co-ops, and land trusts that by design put human and environmental well-being first. Each of these movements advocates for healthy communities, for a moral economy, and for the common good. If they acted together, they would possess enormous collective power. But as yet, there is no whole, only disconnected parts. Despite many achievements, the gap in power between corporations and democratic forces has widened enormously in recent decades. Activists and citizens are beginning to turn this around. We can build on this work. But if we are to close the gap in power, our strategies must evolve. We need to dream bigger, to speak with one voice across issue sectors, and to act more strategically. We need to focus less on symptoms of corporate abuse and more on the underlying cause, excessive corporate power. We must recognize that ultimately our struggle is for power. It's not just to make corporations more responsible, but to make them our servants, in much the same way that elected officials are public servants, or I should interject, are allegedly public servants. We need what the movement now lacks, a coherent vision of the role we want corporations to play in our society, and a strategy for achieving that vision. It's about putting we the people back in charge of our future, rather than the robotic behemoths that set their sights on short-term growth and high profits, regardless of the consequences. The streams of many small movements must flow together into a single river, creating a global movement to bring corporations back under control of citizens and their elected governments. The urgent need for unified action impelled a small group of organizations to initiate a long-term strategic corporate initiative, SCI, of which we are a part. Over the past 18 months, the SCI team interviewed dozens of colleagues and progressive business executives to develop a coherent long-term strategy to rein in corporations. Three major strategic tracks emerged. 1. We need to restore democracy and rebuild countervailing forces that can control corporate power. At the community level, this means elevating the rights of local municipalities over corporations. Communities should have the right to determine what companies do business within their jurisdiction and to establish requirements like living wage standards and environmental safeguards. At the national level, restoring democracy means separating corporations and the state. Corporations and the wealthy should no longer be allowed to dominate the electoral and legislative processes. At the international level, the task is to create agreements and institutions that make social, environmental, and human rights an integral part of global economic rules. 2. We need to severely restrain the realms in which for-profit corporations operate. Most extractive industries, fishing, oil, coal, mining, timber, take wealth from the ecological commons while paying only symbolic amounts to governments and leaving behind damaged ecosystems and depleted resources. The solution is to develop strong institutions that have ownership rights over common wealth. When commons are scarce or threatened, we need to limit that use, assign property rights to trusts or public authorities, and charge market prices to users. With clear legal boundaries and management systems, the conflict over the commons shifts from a lopsided negotiation between powerful global corporations and an outgunned public sector to a dispute resolved by deference to the common good. 3. We need to redesign the corporation itself, as well as the market system in which corporations operate. Companies' internal dynamics currently function like a furnace with a dial that can only be turned up. All the internal feedback loops say faster, higher, more short-term profits. And maximizing short-term profits leads to layoffs, fighting unions, demanding government subsidies, and escalating consumerist strains on the ecosystem. To prevent overheating, the system needs consistent input from non-financial stakeholders so that the demands for profit can be balanced with the rights and needs of employees, the community, and the environment. To end short-termism, company incentives, including executive pay, should be tied to measurements of how well the company serves the common good. Stock options that inflate executive pay should be outlawed or redesigned. Speculative short-term trading in stock should be taxed at significantly higher rates than long-term investments. Companies should be rated on their labor, environmental, and community records, with governments using their financial power through taxes, purchasing, investing, and subsidies to reward the good guys and stigmatize the bad guys. At the same time, we need to celebrate and encourage alternative corporate designs, such as for-benefit corporations, community-owned cooperatives, trusts, and employee-owned companies. The paths outlined here do not represent impossibilities. With a citizens' movement, we could turn these musings into reality in 20 years. Building a global citizens' movement. How can we change laws regulating corporate behavior when corporations dominate the political process? The answer is that change begins with the people, not their government. It always has. Civil society organizations and communities can align their interests to produce a wave that government leaders must either surf upon or drown within. The people control the vital issue of legitimacy, and no system can long stand that loses its legitimacy, as fallen despots of the 20th century have demonstrated. Corporations have already lost much of their moral legitimacy. Business Week in 2002 found that more than 4 out of 5 people believed corporations were too powerful. A national poll by Lake, Snell, Perry, and Merman 2 years ago concluded that over 3/4 of Americans distrust CEOs and blame them for the loss of jobs. An international poll by GlobeScan recently found corporations far behind NGOs in public trust. Trigger events lie ahead that will create further openings for change. We can expect to see new global warming catastrophes, unaffordable energy price spikes, and new corporate scandals. We can capitalize on these openings if we can help people connect the dots, making the link, for example, between excessive CEO pay, companies' short-term focus, and the inability of the private sector to manage long-term problems like the energy crisis and global warming. We also need conceptual frames that link various movements together into a common effort. Currently, our economy is dominated by a market fundamentalism frame, based on the belief that when self-interest is set free, Adam Smith's invisible hand will create prosperity for all. Also dominant is the private property frame, which justifies actions by executives and shareholders to exploit workers, communities, and the environment in order to maximize the value of stockholder and executive property and share ownership. We can advance new frames. Moral economy, for example, is a frame that puts the firing of thousands of employees and the simultaneous awarding of multi-million-dollar bonuses to executives in a moral context. Suggested by Fred Block of the Longview Institute, the moral economy frame invites the introduction of new system forces into market dynamics in order to protect the moral order and to counteract the amoral, short-term, self-interested behavior promoted by market fundamentalism. Within the overarching framework of a moral economy, other frameworks like community and the commons challenge the supremacy of individualism and self-interest in the market fundamentalism frame. Community well-being becomes the standard by which business practices are judged, and communities themselves the arbiters of whether standards are met. The commons represents our shared property and wealth, which is not to be exploited for the selfish benefit of the few. Imagine responsible companies protect the environment as though there is a tomorrow, and they view worker knowledge and companies' reputation in the communities where they operate as their greatest assets. New conceptual frames, trigger events, a crisis of legitimacy. Elements like these can serve to help build a citizens' movement. But we cannot simply wait for this movement to form spontaneously. At the international level, we need regional organizations to come together to agree on overarching priorities. At the national level, we likewise need discussions that forge strategic priorities. At the community level, we need to create a network of municipalities working together to challenge corporate rights, to promote alternative business forms, and to inventory and claim our commonwealth assets. Communities can also take the lead in creating public financing of campaigns and in tying procurement and investment policies to corporate social ratings. The idea is not that people will drop their issues and adopt new ones, but that we can learn to do both at once. We can knit ourselves into a single movement, By adopting common frames and by integrating strategic common priorities into existing campaigns. For example, campaigns covering any issues from the environment to living wages could demand that targeted companies end all involvement in political campaigns. As individuals, we relegate our identities as consumers and investors to secondary status, elevating to first place our identities as citizens and members of families and communities, people with a stewardship responsibility for the natural world and with moral obligations to one another. We can stop buying the story that government is inefficient and wasteful, grasping that the real issue is how corporations and money dominate government. We can stop thinking that the solution is more Democrats in power and realize it is more democracy. The transformative changes we need will not be on any party's agenda until a citizens' movement puts them there. Let me interject here that these transformative changes happen to be on the Green Party's agenda, which, of course, why they're not given any press coverage. Continuing. It's up to us to build that movement. By joining together, by taking on the common structural impediments that block progress, we can make it possible for all of us to achieve the variety of goals we're currently struggling for. How would reducing the underlying power of corporations affect today's issue campaigns? Ending corporate campaign contributions and political advertising would benefit a great many public interest causes. How often in recent years have initiatives to protect forests, increase recycling, provide health care coverage, and raise minimum wages been defeated by corporations who outspent their civil society opponents by a ratio of over 30 to 1? We've all witnessed elected leaders move to the political center once they started receiving a steady flow of corporate contributions. Likewise, if we could reduce the 13,000 registered corporate lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and end the revolving door between government regulators and corporations, would a handful of companies be allowed to own the lion's share of our media? Would savings and loan, energy, transportation, and tobacco companies still have been de- or unregulated? Would oil and coal companies still drive our national energy policy? Imagine what it might be like in 20 years if our efforts are successful and people could once again govern themselves. Let me interject. Imagine if people could govern themselves for the first time. It hasn't been within my half century of lifetime, anyway. Continuing. A line would be carefully drawn between corporations and the state. Reducing financial influence over elections and lawmaking, making possible a whole new generation of progressive elected officials committed to social transformation. I just want to interject here after this paragraph that this paragraph contains a lot of embedded assumptions that I personally don't agree with, that essentially center around what the purpose of the state is and what it's always been. There's a reason why corporations and the state are so aligned. They're both concentrated structures of power designed from the outset to create a hierarchy of dominance. But as I said, I don't necessarily agree word for word with everything that I read, and more than likely, the presentation of this article is going to be comfortable to a lot more people than it is to me personally. So let me continue. In 20 years, imagine that the institutions of the global economy are overhauled so that labor and environmental issues are integrated into trade policies and impoverished nations are freed from unpayable international debts. Trade and investment rules promote fair exchange, and national governments have the policy space to support social and environmental goals at home. Transnational corporations that take destructive action are held accountable in a world court for corporate crimes. In 20 years, imagine community self-governance has become the new norm. No longer can companies open new stores in communities where they are unwanted, or play communities off against one another to extract illegitimate public subsidies. We value and protect our precious commonwealth, from ecological commons like air, water, fisheries, and seeds, to cultural commons like music and science. In 20 years, imagine that it is a violation of fiduciary responsibility for corporations to pay CEOs obscene amounts or to aggressively fight unions and lobby against environmental safeguards. Responsible companies protect the environment as though there is a tomorrow, and they view worker knowledge and the company's reputation in the communities where they operate as their greatest assets. Imagine such companies receive preferential treatment in government purchasing, taxation, and investment policies, while irresponsible companies find themselves barred from government contracts. Imagine we have a new national policy to make employee ownership as widespread as home ownership is today, and alternative company designs like cooperatives and new for-benefit companies grow and flourish. Imagine, in other words, that we the people are able to reclaim our economy and society from corporate control, daring to dream that such a turn of events is possible. And charting the path to get there is the critical challenge of our new century. And that was an article titled, Who Will Rule? By Michael Marks and Marjorie Kelly, published in the fall 2007 edition of Yes magazine. Michael Marks is Director of Corporate Ethics International, CEI, in Portland, Oregon. Marjorie Kelly is with the TELUS Institute in Boston and the author of The Divine Right of Capital. They're part of the Strategic Corporate Initiative, a group unifying efforts to curtail corporate power and igniting change toward a more humane, sustainable, democratic society and economy. We'll continue in that same vein with two presentations from a conference, Taming the Giant Corporation, put on by Ralph Nader's organization, Public Citizen, last summer in Washington, D.C.
Our next panelist is Gar Alperovitz, who is a political scientist and economist who teaches here at the University of Maryland, College Park. You may know many of his books, The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb, and more recently, America Beyond Capitalism. I give you Gar Alperovitz.
Thank you. I wear two hats, both as a historian and a political economist. And there's something to know about the building you're sitting in, which is very important. So just let that hang there. The planning for the first atomic bomb was done in this building, the bureaucratic planning. So know where you are. First atomic bomb was developed. There were government committees. The major government committees met in this building. Okay, I wrote a book about the atomic. Wrote a couple books about the atomic bomb. Can you hear me now? Okay, someone raise a hand if it doesn't work out. The website to look at is, if I forget this, www.community-wealth.com or .org. Either way, you can get there. So that's a lot of things I'm going to talk about very briefly, all too briefly. Let me say this. I think that any great historical movement inevitably is complex. It involves criticism, challenge, cultural change, legal change, reconstructive change, counter-institutional change. It is not a simple thing. So I'm only going to be able to talk about one part of it, but I want to lay that out there first. Second thing is, I think this is the most interesting political economic period of my adult lifetime, and I'll say why. It could easily turn into a period, one great terror, one more bomb here, and the clampdown would appear something like fascism. So that possibility exists. I'm a realist, the possibility of no change exists. But the possibility of entering a context in which we, let me say this carefully, lay the foundations for a potential major change, I think are also real. So let me say why I say that contextually, and then we'll talk about three or four things in the time I've got. One, What we're entering as the empire declines may be the first period in the 21st and 20th century in which war has not been the most fundamental distraction from the domestic problems of the United States. Let me say what I mean by that. In the first quarter of the 20th century, major difficulties were building up politically, and World War I grabbed the attention, destroyed the labor movement such as it was, and the left movements, and recreated a scare movement. In the second quarter of the century, the Great Depression, and not solved until World War II, did the same thing. In the third quarter of the century, the Cold War, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, all put the eye on foreign policy as the central issue. What has now begun to happen, it took 26,000 American lives before the American people said, we don't want that war anymore in Vietnam, and then another 26,000 to get out. This one, we're at 3,000 and a little more, and people are saying we want out, and the trend is clearly down because people on the one hand around the world are saying no, and on the other hand, the American people don't want to send their kids. What that may mean is we are taking the war issue in the new era away from its capacity to distract from domestic difficulties. That's number one. Number two, someone mentioned today, only once in the time I was here, I wasn't here all day, the radical decline of the labor movement. Now, the labor movement was at 33%, 33.5% in the mid-50s. It is now at 12 or 11% total, and in the private sector it's at 7% and declining. The progressive movement nationally that provided the welfare state or the corporate state and the reforms thereof were fueled in great part in all countries around the world by a significant labor movement, and that is declining before your eyes, which means to me that the trends are going to get worse before they get better, but it does not mean the end of history, I think. So I don't think we're going to end, I don't think we're going to see easy reforms at the national level, though in a complex way I would support whatever we can get because people are in very great pain. Third, at the internal empire, this is an internal empire, the great continental internal empire, the pain at the local level and at the state level is increasing. All the trends are, many of the trends have probably been discussed. That is the wage rates, the dislocations, environmental problems. On virtually every major trend, incarceration, particularly of blacks, we are the most, by far, the greatest number of people per capita in any of the advanced systems in jail, and it has been increasing, 7 times the European average. On liberty, if you like to want to measure liberty, even before the Patriot Act, the number of people put away in prisons in this country is extraordinary. Richard Posner, a very conservative judge, says, we put more people in jail than any other country except the Arab countries like Saudi Arabia per capita. So liberty, inequality, power of the corporation, environmental trends with very few exceptions have been down. There are a couple particulates, SO2, NO2, maybe some of the lakes, but on virtually every major trend is down and probably will not be reversed and will probably not collapse. So I think we're entering an era in which the system, and it's specific, the system does not succeed at the national level, but Marxists in the room, it doesn't collapse either. It decays before your eyes. It's a very odd system and a very odd context we are entering. In one sense, it's a process of delegitimation. That 35 years ago, if you asked people, do you believe the government does what the people want? Is it a democracy? 7 out of 8 would have said yes. There's been a steady decline now. It's just about reversed. 7 out of 8 will say, no, it's the corporations, the vested interests, and the rich who run the system. From one point of view, that's interesting poll data. From a historical point of view, that's a process of delegitimating the very nature of the government, and it's important as the historical context. So that is a very odd context. The name of the game, part three, or part four, the name of the game in all systems, from my point of view, and I think historically from our point of view, is what the hell do you do with large economic entities in any system? Anybody come here by car or airplane, use a computer, want the best health care, want a CAT scan? What do you do about large economic entities because they develop power in corporate systems and capitalist systems and socialist systems? How do you constrain them? How do you make democracy rule in the name? What's the name of the game? No one has yet answered that question. No one. And there is no simple answer to that question. The question over time is whether in the emerging context, in my view, we can build up a system which partly constrains the excesses of the current model, partly, and I will take whatever regulation I can get because, as I said, there's great difficulties and great pain, but also begins the process of historically constructing an alternative way of doing real-world change for the large economic institutions. Now, what would that involve? One is, and I probably agree with several of the people here who said we need to change the name of the game from taming the corporation, in my view, to beyond the corporation. But that doesn't let you off the hook. It doesn't tell you how to organize large-scale industry. It doesn't tell you how to organize the power systems at any economic entity that's large, how they run. We can begin the process, and here I would draw on some of the things that Dennis said today. It is possible to begin to develop in the places where you might expect it, the ends of the internal empire, the ends of the internal empire where the pain at the local level is greatest, you might begin to see the redevelopment of alternative models from which you could begin to construct serious systems of democratic control and new models. So what do I mean? There are 120 million Americans who self-identify as co-ops, as co-op members, and most people don't know that. A large section of that is a credit union. But it is a collective ownership structure, a collective ownership structure, which tells you something about a different model at the local level that might be not-for-profit, not corporate, not capitalist, common in some sense. In many, many communities, particularly communities of dislocation, there are employee-owned companies all over the country. Most people don't know about this. There are more people involved in employee-owned companies than there are members of unions in the private sector in the United States, some 10,000 such companies. Most of them are ESOPs, which have both – all of these systems, by the way, are flawed – which have both positive and negative results, but they involve a different model of ownership other than the corporation and other than the entrepreneur. It is a collective model which anchors jobs in local communities. They don't get up and run to Mexico. Why? They stabilize communities, and they teach people something about models of cooperation that are different from the corporate model. There are 4,600 neighborhood-owned corporations, nonprofits, which use the development process to support neighborhood services. 4,600 now, some of them good, some of them bad, some of them very large, some of them in New Jersey, for instance, in Newark, 1,600 employees in a nonprofit, mini-socialist, geographic area, public ownership for the geographic area, and they use the profits for training, for health care, and at the same time feed it back into housing, et cetera, et cetera. Some of them are very large. There's one up in Harlem, about $400 million in real estate, mostly housing and some stores, nonprofit, mini-socialist operation, but a different model. At many in the state level, you know about the – what I'm trying to suggest to you all too briefly is that there's an undercurrent growing in many parts of the country, in significant part out of pain, that is somehow different from the traditional models upon which another stage could build. Some of you know about what's happened in the Alaska Corporation, very interesting and very odd public ownership of the resource, three-quarters of the money from oil development – hold on, oil – three-quarters goes to fund the state budget. The other quarter goes to people as a matter of legal right, as a matter of legal right, using that resource under a different ownership pattern. In the year 2000, which was the peak year, it's about $2,000 per person as a matter of legal right. If you had three kids, a couple with three kids got $10,000 as a matter of right. Every citizen got $2,000. So it's a different model. Even in the odd maverick state of Alabama, you'll find that the public pension fund invests in worker-owned companies to keep jobs in the state. Very strange stuff that people haven't been looking at. CalPERS is another model. In California, the public pension system, using public capital, invests partly to target jobs, partly to control executives' salaries, partly in overseas to deal with rights and liberties. Probably you've run into them. They use the power of ownership to begin to constrain corporate behavior. None of these models at this stage of development would I say answer the problem. What is significant is we are moving at many, many levels to gather the kind of experience that would be required as the decay increases to develop national and regional models. In my book, I try to lay out some of the possibilities that would entail as you go forward. But I want to reiterate something that Dennis said today that's very significant for people who care about this kind of process of change, and it's this. You want to play this game? The chips are decades of your life. You can't play otherwise. It requires people who want to develop step by step what it might be required to transform the largest, most powerful political economic system in the history of the world. That means you've got to lay it down for decades, and you need to begin to think about what it would require, what pieces would have to be in place as the decay increases, to begin to develop an alternative vision. That will ultimately involve cultural change, legal change, et cetera. But the central problem, which cannot be ducked in any system, is how do we generate a model that allows large economic entities? The socialist systems were worse in some ways. Take a look at what happened in those backward systems on ecological matters, for instance. How do you control those systems? One other piece of the puzzle. How am I doing on time? One other little piece of the puzzle I want to suggest to you, and this is maybe the hardest. If you're living in a society, as the United States is, of 300 million people, that is continental in scale, you tell me how you can have participatory democracy in that system. Furthermore, as it moves over this century to at least 400 million by mid-century and probably 500 million by most estimates, and by the high Census Bureau estimate to 1.2 billion by the end of the century, how do we have democracy in such a system? So here is a nasty question for those of you who want to play the game and want to throw some decades on the card table. If most states are too small to manage large economic entities and the nation is too big, ultimately we are looking at something called a regional reconstruction. That's the logical result. So how do you put that into real-world American terms starting here and now, and what do you do tomorrow? California is probably the only interesting regional skies polity that exists, and the beginnings of most interesting environmental practices are beginning in California. The possibility of mobilizing a progressive alliance in California, those possibilities suggest one possibility for long-term regional change. It is not the end of the game. It is a fragmentary suggestion of what might be the scale of what would be required. New England, now that they've gotten rid of the Mitt Romney situation, I don't know what to say about him. New England is beginning to develop and redevelop the regional alliance on environmental policy, putting that region together. But the logical problem of how to deal with large scale in geography and population also cannot be avoided. So either we begin to think through that process seriously and then begin to tailor our approach from that perspective, or we lose the game. So what I'm saying is structure is one piece to look at. If you don't like the if you don't like capitalism, you don't like socialism, what the hell do you want, and what does it look like, and what do you do about the large corporation, and how do you learn enough to build steadily towards new models? What do you do about scale, ultimately? What do you do about time? Are you willing to play? What do you do about time? And then most important, how do we get from here to there tomorrow? My view would be that is we need to take walk on two legs would be the way to think about it, the old Chinese expression. We need to do what we can do to constrain and simultaneously rebuild in all realms, not only the structural, but the cultural, the political, and also the ideological. And also, finally, we need to take a page from the old women's movement of the 1960s. What was that page? Women's movement figured out that Chairman Mao was wrong. Chairman Mao's line was, power emerges from the barrel of a gun. The women's movement in the early 60s said, no, power comes when five or six people get together, get some coffee, begin to read, talk to each other and learn something, reinforce each other from the talking and the support and the ideas. What do we really want and how do we build? That's where power comes from. In my view, that element has been missing. We have not been developing seriously our ideas about where we want to go. We've been kind of dealing with protest, we've been dealing with reform, we've been dealing with holding back, we've been dealing with culture, but we haven't developed seriously the kind of dialogue it would take to begin to advance a real agenda for the longer haul. So, one final word. I'm from Wisconsin. I grew up in the period of the Joe McCarthy's era. And if you asked anybody at that time, I heard a lot of pessimism today. If you asked anybody at that time, read the tea leaves of the time, and if you lived in Wisconsin, where they shot anything that moved politically. McCarthy was big nationally, but in Wisconsin he was enormous. Well, obviously what you knew from the 1950s and Joe McCarthy was nothing could ever change. And of course the next thing that happened was the 1960s. I am not an optimist utopian. As I said, I think this could easily become semi-fascist or even worse. On the other hand, Chile got beyond Pinochet, and the same questions remain. On the other hand, I think there is a real possibility that this particular country and its ideals and its people and the concerns that Dennis was talking about may have the potential to explode furthermore over time, just as happened in the 60s, and just as happened, most interestingly, in the conservative era, which was even weaker in the 1940s than the liberals are today, and they developed what it took to become the most powerful conservative movement, which will be pushed off the edge shortly, I hope. Thank you very much.
That was Gar Alperowitz, author of America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy.
Our next speaker is Andrew Kimbrell. He's a public interest attorney and founder of two groups, the International Center for Technology Assessment and the Center for Food Safety. And just to make sure you pay really close attention to what he says, let me mention that the Utney Reader once named him as one of the 100 of the world's 100 leading visionaries. He also has a new book out called Your Right to Know about genetic engineering in food. And today he's going to talk about the relationship between corporations and technology. So please welcome Andy.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Rob, and everyone for inviting me here to talk about. See, I'm supposed to talk about technology, the precautionary principle, and anything else in 20 minutes, I suppose. The steroid scandal in Major League Baseball, you know. We'll do food, too. Yeah, I was named one of the 100 leading visionaries in the United States by the Utney Reader a couple years back, and they invited us to come to Town Hall in New York City to be visionary, I guess, to say visionary things. And I was the fifth visionary to speak, and I noticed that the first four visionaries had very thick glasses. And it occurred to me then that maybe a prerequisite of being a visionary is you really can't see at all. So you should take that as a caveat, I guess, on what I'm going to say. I also have to admit to being a lawyer. Sarah was right there, too. I've written a couple of books on bioethics, and a cab driver here in D.C. asked me what was the difference between a sperm and a lawyer, which is a bioethics question I had not dealt with before. And when I couldn't answer, he said, well, the difference is, you see, the sperm has at least a 1 in 1 million chance of becoming a human being. You can also use 1 in 1 million chance of working. Either one works. I want to start, actually, with something a little bit different, because I know it's been discussed earlier here. The idea of legal action as being an effective tool for taming corporations. And I think one of the things that's very important as we look at the variety of tools to fight this monolith is that we don't be either or. We do a lot of grassroots organizing. But I think it's very important to emphasize, particularly for lawyers in the group, that we can do effective damage to corporations through the legal process. It is not something we should give up on. It should be part of our arsenal. And let me give you a couple of examples. Last month, my organization, the Center for Food Safety, led and argued a case in the Ninth Circuit to try to stop Monsanto from planting genetically modified alfalfa throughout the United States, which contaminates. It's the fourth largest crop in the United States. It would contaminate all organic and traditional alfalfa. We originally sued the USDA. Monsanto intervened, at which point USDA basically, I've never seen this before in 25 years of being a lawyer in this town, moved out. So we'll just let Monsanto handle the entire case. So Monsanto came in with 10 lawyers, one of whom was Dick Cheney's son-in-law, which made it especially sweet. And we won the case for the very first time, a federal court. For the very first time, a federal court permanently enjoined the planting of genetically modified crop because it would biologically pollute conventional and organic crops. So, and also demanded that wherever it has been planted be published on a public website so all farmers could see it and the public would know where these contaminating crops were. So, again, this is about a $235 million hit that Monsanto took. I would consider that taming it just a little bit. And I know people talked about the global warming lawsuit, the 5-4 case, and the Supreme Court recently ruled. Let me just quickly tell you how that came about. In 1999, me and my legal partner, Joe Mendelson, wondered why we couldn't sue the EPA for not regulating global warming gases. And so we petitioned them. Now, this was during the Clinton administration, and the EPA called us in and said, you know, we think you got us legally. We think these are air pollutants, and the Clean Air Act is supposed to regulate air pollutants, so we think you guys are right. But when the Bush administration came in, right, they completely closed that down and refused to even answer the petition. So then we sued them, saying this is unreasonable delay. Are greenhouse gas emissions, are they air pollutants or not? And they refused to answer us. We sued them, finally got an answer, and they said, no, global warming is not proved. We then sued the EPA. We were joined by several states. We lost at the appellate level. And then we won 5-4 in the Supreme Court. And let's just show you, here's two lawyers, and then there was only four of us, now there's eight of us in our organization, who came up with this concept, fought it all the way through, and won a 5-4 decision. Now, again, I'm not suggesting this is the answer, but I'm suggesting, do these two stories show you that this is an important tool in the arsenal that we should not ignore as far as taming corporations? Very, very important. I want to move right from there to, Ralph talked about the evolving nature of corporate power. And one of the things I want to touch upon briefly is something I deal with every day, which is how corporations are now actually altering the very nature of nature itself through genetic engineering and nanotechnology. You know, we're caught in kind of a technological dilemma, all of us, which is that we've gotten so used to our technologies that we can't live without them. But now this whole new genre of global environmental threats, we know we can't live with them either. So I think almost everyone in this room would agree that we need to devolve our technologies and make sure they comport with nature and human nature. And in the 1970s, I was part of the appropriate technology movement. We thought this was inevitable, right? As these tremendous global problems hit, we knew we were going to have to change our technologies so they fit natural systems. Makes sense. What other way could there possibly be? Well, I was wrong, and we were wrong. There was an alternative, and that's really, when you look at genetic engineering and nanotechnology, there was an alternative. They were saying, let's not change our technology or economic system so it fits nature. Let's change nature so it fits our technology and our economic system. And this really is the breathtaking effort that you see now with biotechnology and genetic engineering. Again, they're saying, oh, to change the technology economic system means the Monsantos of the world are gone. So we're going to change the world so it fits our corporate and technological needs. Let me give you a couple of examples on this. 85% of all the genetically engineered crops in the world have been engineered so they can tolerate more and more herbicide use. They're called Roundup Ready. Roundup being, of course, Monsanto's flagship product, right? Now, you know, anybody who's gardening, you know, if you spray, you know, herbicide on your weeds and it gets on your flowers or crop, what happens to the flowers or crop? It dies. Real problem for Monsanto, right? You can only use a certain amount of it. You can't use aerial spraying. So what they did is they genetically engineered these crops. Again, 85% of all the crops in the United States and the world are, this is what they have in them. So you could do aerial spraying of the herbicide, of Roundup Ready, over all the crops. They genetically changed the very permanent nature of our corn, our soy, our canola, cotton, and they would have with alfalfa, to fit their corporate needs, which is to sell more and more herbicides. Now, we already know we have too much herbicide in the environment. We already know that weeds are getting herbicide resistant. So you'd think we would change our technology to fit nature. Nature can't stand this load of poisons. You're creating resistance in the very weeds that you're trying to get rid of, making it more and more difficult to kill them. So let's devolve our technology. Let's use more sustainable agricultural tools. Monsanto said, no, that doesn't profit us. We make the chemicals. So we're going to change nature so it fits our needs. We're actually going to change the permanent genetic code of plants so they can tolerate more and more herbicide use. So we now have over 120 million tons more of herbicide used in our fields in the last 7 years since these plants have really been around. And in corn, it's magnified 7 times, soy about 8 times. So here you see where a corporation is literally changing nature, evolving the power of a corporation to actually change the permanent genetic code of nature. And they're doing the same with nanotechnology. And they're saying, listen, don't worry about global warming. We're going to genetically engineer plants so they can survive drought. Right? One of the problems they have in factory farming is that egg-laying hens still have a brooding instinct. So they take more time, they get very upset in those horrific battery cages. One of the great crimes of our time is what happens to the 10 billion animals that we use for food. Just one of the great crimes of modern times. So what they did at Purdue University is they tried to genetically engineer the hens to take out their mothering instinct.
Oh my God.
They're doing that right now with taxpayer dollars, our dollars. Right? Let's not change this horrifically inhumane system of treating animals, egg layers. Let's not have free range. Let's engineer them so they fit our system, our technology, our profit. Right? So this is really, when you think about genetic engineering and technology, I would give you this context that this is the evolving nature of corporate power to actually change at the genetic and now through nanotechnology, the molecular level, nature itself, so it comports with what we do. I cannot imagine a more dramatic moment in the battle against corporations when they are enclosing the very nature of nature and human nature. And I would note before we feel, oh, my God, that's terrible what they're doing to the hens, it's horrible what they're doing to the crops and animals, that 60 million of us are on psychotropic medication to get through our work days. And over 100 million are on psychotropic medication, and I have to raise my hand on this one, to get through the night. Right? Psychotropic medication. This is prescription drugs. Depressants, antidepressants, anti-anxieties, diazepine, the whole group of them, right? 60 million people get through the day, 100 plus to get through the night, right? So they're not going to change the pace of work so it fits human nature. They're not going to change the speed of the line, so to speak. The fact that we get about 2 hours less of sleep, for example, on average than than that last generation did. No, they're going to drug us so that we can put up with it. They're not going to change the system. We're being changed biochemically to fit the system. This is the evolving nature of corporate power. And I think it's a very, very dramatic evolution that we need to confront very dramatically. I want to move from there to talk a little about the nature of technology in corporations. Often I go to a lot of these corporate conferences. I'm a board member of the International Forum on Globalization, which is one of my favorite organizations in the entire world. And no one talks about technology. There is no corporations without massive technology, right? Corporations did not create themselves. They were created because of the developments of technology in the 18th and 19th century. Let me give you an example. The mistake here is to think that technology is neutral and it's only the bad guy corporations that are making it bad. That's the mistake, fundamental mistake. Let me give you an example. Let's take nuclear power. What do you need for nuclear power? Well, what do you need to build a nuclear power plant? Let's say we're all going to build it. What do we need? Raw materials, which are? Uranium, what else you need? Huge amounts of water, huge amounts of concrete, right? This all costs money, largest capital investment you can ever make, right, is nuclear power plant, right? You need bureaucracy for safety, right? You need a military elite because of its potential use in the military. You need huge insurance, and you need, right, a centralized system of energy, right? You're creating a huge amount of energy. You don't build a nuclear power plant for two blocks in a neighborhood. You're building a huge centralized energy source. This is what I call a totalitarian technology, right? Because the technology is not neutral. Inherent in it is a military elite, huge capital investment, right? Huge bureaucracy, huge centralization of power, literally, and massive use of natural resources. And if we today say, listen, we're holding this incredibly important corporations meeting, and we don't want any of the light here to be created by the nuclear power plants in this area, Calver Cliffs. We call today. What will the response be on the other side? Laughter. Guy goes home. You can't believe the call I got today. He's nuts. Said I was somehow going to be able to, you know. So the fundamental thing of any democracy, right, is that that democracy is responsive to you and you can take responsibility for it. These are totalitarian technologies because they are not responsive to us and we cannot take responsibility ultimately for what they do. We have to look at technologies as not neutral, but look at various technologies to see if they are totalitarian. And it is those totalitarian technologies that require massive technocracies to run them. They can be corporations, or in state capitalist societies like the former Soviet Union, they can be huge bureaucracies. If you have a massive centralized technology, you will have a corporation or a corporate-like structure technocracy to run it. No other way to do it. So if you really want to tame corporations, you've got to tame technology at the same time. There is no other alternative. Think that you're just going to change the corporate structure and not change the very body, the totalitarian technologies that make up our society, is naive. It's like worrying about the icing and forgetting about the cake. So take solar energy. It has the potential, right, to have no massive corporate money involved, no military elite, no massive bureaucracies, no centralized control of the energy, but individual and community control. So there's a technology that's potential to be democratic. Those are the technologies we have to build the body of our society up if we truly want a democratic society. And if we truly want to get rid of these massive corporations, they can't live on that kind of centralized control. So I would urge you, when you all of your work on corporations, remember the idea of these technological, basically totalitarian corporate-run technological systems. And now that those technological systems are being run by corporations and they're trying to turn all of nature, including human nature, into a technological system, a very, very dramatic moment for us. We need to fight democracy at the technology level, not just at the political level.